WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Turi Gross with Fresh Air. And today's Fresh Air, what to do when sleep won't come. We talk with Dr. Sonia Ancoli Israel, who directs a sleep disorders clinic in San Diego and is the author of the new book, All I Want is a Good Night's Sleep. The good news is she says the ability to sleep is something you can learn. Also, film critic John Powers reviews A Time to Kill based on John Grisham's first novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Robots and divers are mapping a field of airplane debris off Long Island. There are many more divers participating in the search today for victims and wreckage of TWA Flight 800. 122 victims are still missing. NPR's Melissa Block reports.
A high-tech Navy vessel is on the scene now with a decompression chamber that will allow the divers to stay underwater much longer. The ship also has underwater robots to scan the ocean floor. The hunt focuses on what investigators are calling a major debris field, which includes a 45-foot-tall piece of wreckage. Searchers are also hoping to lift a 60-by-30-foot piece of fuselage discovered Monday with some bodies underneath. Meanwhile, conflicting reports about whether more bodies have been spotted underwater have left family members furious, not knowing whether to get their hopes up or not. As to what caused TWA Flight 800 to explode in midair, investigators say they're not discounting any theory, including a bomb planted on board, a surface-to-air missile, or catastrophic mechanical failure. On Long Island, I'm Melissa Block.
Relatives of victims aboard TWA Flight 800 are complaining about confusion in the search for bodies. Some say New York Governor George Pataki misled them when he suggested search crews had located dozens more bodies on the ocean floor. The governor's office says Pataki just repeated what search investigators told him. U.S. Middle East envoy Dennis Ross is in Damascus for talks with Syrian President Hafez al-Assad. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Syria's government-run newspaper Al-Twada warned that if the Clinton administration does not stand up to the hardline policies of Israel's new government, the stalled Middle East peace process will end up in a complete failure. The editorial appeared during the visit to Syria by U.S. envoy Dennis Ross. He met yesterday with Syrian Foreign Minister Farouk al-Sharaa in preparation for today's talks with President Assad. Ross is trying to assure Syrian leaders that Washington is still committed to the peace process after the election of Benjamin Netanyahu as Israel's new prime minister. Talks between Israel and Syria broke off in March. Syria wants Washington to pressure Israel to agree to a full withdrawal from the strategic Golan Heights, captured by the Jewish state during the 1967 Six-Day War. Netanyahu pledged during his campaign that the occupied Arab land would remain under Israeli control. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
The State Department confirms the president of Burundi sought refuge in the U.S. Embassy in Bujumbura today. A security official for the Central African nation made the announcement. Burundi's president, Sylvestre Ntibantanganya, is an ethnic Hutu. Just now, the Associated Press, quoting close presidential aides in Burundi, say the Tutsi-led military has staged an apparent coup in Burundi. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 11 points at 5,359. This is NPR. The Senate has approved a plan overhauling the national welfare system. The vote was 74 to 24. Senate Democrats split on the issue. Republicans wish to limit the amount of time welfare recipients can stay on the rolls. Able-bodied people would be required to work. Opponents argue the bill is too harsh on children. A conference committee will iron out the differences between the Senate and House versions before a finished bill is sent to President Clinton. The wife of veteran Chinese dissident Liu Nianchun today appealed to Chinese authorities to give her husband urgent medical attention. He's serving 3 years in a labor camp. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports from Beijing.
Liu Nianchun disappeared a year ago in May when police searched his Beijing home and took him away. But it was only last month that Liu's wife, Chu Hailan, was told that Liu is serving a 3-year sentence in a labor camp for supposedly accepting aid from international human rights organizations. After visiting her husband last week, Chu today wrote an appeal to Chinese authorities, asking them to provide Liu with immediate medical care. In her letter, she said Liu had been beaten and tortured daily by organized groups of criminals. Despite these problems, Liu this month filed a lawsuit against Beijing authorities, saying he should be released because he has not broken any law. The Beijing District Court has refused to consider the appeal on the grounds that it doesn't understand it. I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Beijing.
Foreign criminals may be at large in the United States thanks to a passport scam involving a senior official with the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service. Prosecutors say official Jerry Stuchner will plead guilty in a Hong Kong court to possessing fake Honduran passports he knew would be sold. Thousands of people used the passports, including suspects in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Well, how did you sleep last night? What do you do on those nights when sleep won't come? My guest, Dr. Sonia Ancoli Israel, has some good suggestions. She's the author of All I Want is a Good Night's Sleep, offering information on everything from melatonin to counting sheep. She directs the Sleep Disorders Clinic at the San Diego Veterans Affairs Medical Center and teaches in the Department of Psychiatry at the School of Medicine at the University of California in San Diego. She's also on the editorial board of the journal Sleep. I asked what you should do at 3 a.m. if you're going through a phase when you can't sleep.
That's a horrible thing to experience. There's several things that you have to think about. First of all, what is the very first thing that you do when you wake up at 3 a.m? Terry, if you were to wake up at 3 a.m, what's the first thing you would do?
Okay, the first thing I would do is say, okay, now I'll try to fall back asleep.
Even before that, the first thing you'd probably do is look at the clock.
Okay.
Right? Now, in order to look at the clock, you have to open your eyes, you have to turn your head, perhaps even lift your head, and you have to wake up enough to comprehend what time the clock is telling you. So what you're doing is waking yourself up even more. So no matter what time of the night it is, I mean, does it really matter if it's 3 o'clock or 1 o'clock? In either case, you don't want to be awake. So the best thing to do when you wake up in the middle of the night is to lay there with your eyes closed, try to stay relaxed, and there's a greater probability that you'll fall back to sleep rather than waking yourself up even more.
I know the impulse to look at the clock. It's like, how am I doing?
That's right. Or, you know, what time is it really? Do I need
slept?
That's right. Or how many hours before I have to get up? And may I, you know, maybe I won't sleep during that time.
Right.
What you have to do is turn the clock around so you can't see it. Or move it somewhere so you're not even tempted to turn it around to look at it. Get it out of the way. You know it'll go off. The alarm will go off when you need to get up. You don't have to worry about that part. So put it somewhere where it won't be a distraction.
Well, I always wonder this. If once I've kind of given up, once I've like lied there for a half hour, then it's 45 minutes, and then it's at an hour, and you keep getting more and more restless and uncomfortable
right.
as time
right.
passes. Then I get to the point where I think like, okay, should I just kind of call it quits and pick up the remote control or try a magazine or go to right. the kitchen and eat something?
The worst thing you can do when you wake up in the middle of the night is lay there and toss and turn and get more tense. Of course, and the harder you try to go to sleep, the tenser you get, and then the harder it is, of course, to fall asleep. So if after about 10 or 15 minutes, if you find yourself tossing and turning, what you want to do is get out of bed. You don't want to lay there anymore. You don't want to grab the remote or read in bed. You want to leave the bedroom, go into another room, make yourself comfortable, and then it's okay to read or turn on the TV as long as you're doing something that isn't going to be more anxiety-provoking. You don't want to start watching or reading a murder mystery that's going to get you so involved that you're not going to want to go back to bed. And you stay out of bed until you think you're sleepy enough to fall asleep. At that point, you go back to bed, you get into bed, and if you, again, can't fall asleep within 10 or 15 minutes, you get out of bed again. And you keep doing that until you can get into bed and fall asleep. That might mean that you don't fall asleep till 6 in the morning if you have to keep getting out of bed. Along with that, though, you have to get up at the same time that you would normally have gotten up. So if your clock usually goes off at 7 a.m., even if you don't fall asleep till 6, you have to get up at 7.
Why?
Because you don't want to shift your circadian rhythms. If you sleep late in the morning, you'll have a harder time falling asleep that night again.
Mm-hmm.
So what you want to do, the keystone, the cornerstone to all good sleep habits is getting up at the same time every day. That means no sleeping in on Sunday mornings. Now, this only holds for people with difficulty sleeping. If you have no trouble sleeping, then whatever you're doing is fine. But if you have the complaint of insomnia, then you have to get up at the same time every day in order to stabilize your circadian rhythm, your biological clock. Along with that, you have to avoid all naps during the day. So you may only get maybe 4 hours sleep that night because you're constantly getting out of bed. But if you avoid napping, then the next night when you go to bed, you'll be much sleepier and you'll have an easier time falling asleep, or if you wake up in the middle of the night, going back to sleep again.
Now, I want to get back to your advice to get out of bed if you're really restless and go read in the kitchen or read in the living
right.
room. Now, I've heard other people say, if you're in bed, even though if you're restless and you think you'll never sleep again, if you lie there long enough and close your eyes, eventually, in spite of yourself, you're going to fall back asleep.
Not only do you eventually fall back to sleep, you might actually doze in and out, which you don't realize. The distinction is if you're anxious about it. If you can lay there, even for an hour or two, and feel relaxed and not get uptight about it, then that's terrific, and then you probably will doze in and out and get more sleep and rest than you realize. But if you're laying there and you're tossing and turning and you're getting upset and you're saying, oh my God, I've got to get up in an hour and what am I going to do and I'm going to be miserable tomorrow, and you're getting more and more upset about it, that's going to make it harder and harder to fall asleep. Not only that, that could contribute to a much more chronic insomnia, so that every time you get into bed, you go, oh God, I just know I'm not going to be able to sleep when I get into bed.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're trying to avoid. We call that psychophysiological insomnia. It's really a negative conditioning where you've learned that when you get into bed, you can't sleep because you're getting so tense. And that's what we want to avoid.
Is there any point to counting sheep or counting in general?
Absolutely. That's a very good technique when your mind is wandering or when your mind is very busy analyzing everything that's going on in your life instead of being quiet. It's a way to quiet the mind. It's no different than meditation or counting your breaths. The idea is to focus your mind on one object or one thought. And in that way, your mind will relax and it'll keep from doing all the worrying that we tend to do when we're up in the middle of the night.
Now, we've been talking about the condition where you're in a temporary period where you can't sleep. What about people who just can't sleep? They have insomnia most of the time.
Right.
What causes that?
Many of the things that I just talked about are actually true for chronic insomnia as well as transient insomnia. Insomnia is not a sleep disorder. Insomnia is a complaint. It means that person has difficulty falling asleep, difficulty staying asleep, or both. But it can be caused by many other things, some of which are disorders themselves. So, for example, it can be caused by medical illness, whether it's the pain of arthritis that's keeping you up at night, or heart disease. It can be caused by medication use. Almost all medications can or will list sleep as a side effect. It's either a stimulant, and if you take it in the evening, it can disturb your sleep, or it's a depressant, and if you take it during the day, it might make you sleepy during the day. Sometimes by having your physician adjust the dose or the time of day that you're taking a medication could improve the insomnia or the sleep problem. It can be caused by psychological problems. Depression, for example, is one of the most common causes of insomnia. It can be caused by circadian rhythm disturbances, changes or shifts in our biological clocks. For example, jet lag, when you're traveling across time zones, will cause insomnia. It can be caused by stress in one's life. So there are many, many different things that can cause insomnia.
Sometimes I wonder if people who have insomnia just need less sleep and they're just in bed too long. They expect to sleep longer than their body needs to sleep.
There are actually two good points there. One is that many people don't realize how many hours they need to sleep. And there are some people that we call short sleepers who can get by on 5 or 6. And there are some who are long sleepers who might need 10 or 11. Most people need around 8 to 9 hours of sleep. But there are individual differences, just like there is with anything else in our lives. The second point is that the longer we stay in bed, the more fragmented and disturbed sleep becomes. The less time we spend in bed, the more consolidated our sleep is. So 8 hours of sleep out of 8.5 hours in bed is actually much more efficient than eight hours of sleep out of 10 or 11 hours in bed. Now, what does the insomniac do? I didn't sleep much last night. I think I'll go to bed 2 hours earlier tonight to try to get more sleep. And what they're doing then is spending too much time in bed and making their sleep worse.
What are your suggestions for people who have chronic insomnia?
The first thing a chronic insomniac needs to do is figure out what initially caused the insomnia. And that usually will mean working with some health professional who can go through with them and try to determine which of the different factors we mentioned, the medical, the psychiatric, the medication, the stress, etc., originally caused the insomnia, and then work at treating that original problem. The second thing is that no matter what your sleep problem is, once it's begun, it almost always involves some poor sleep hygiene. And by that I mean basically bad sleep habits. So the insomniac has to try to evaluate what he or she is doing that can be improved. For example, spending too much time in bed would be one example of poor sleep hygiene. So don't spend so much time in bed. Don't sleep in the morning. Get up at the same time every day. Don't spend time in bed getting anxious. Don't drink caffeine or ingest caffeine anytime after lunch. And remember that caffeine is not just in coffee, but in teas and in sodas and in chocolate. I love to tell people a soda doesn't have to be brown to have caffeine in it. And most people think it's only the brown sodas that
mm-hmm.
do. Avoid alcohol in the evening. Everybody's heard that if you have difficulty sleeping, you should have a glass of wine or sherry before you go to bed. Alcohol makes you sleepy initially, but several hours later, when the alcohol leaves your bloodstream, it actually wakes you back up again. So if you have a glass of wine or something to drink before going to bed, you'll fall asleep faster, but at 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, you're going to wake right back up again. Or if you drink a lot with dinner, you might be sleepy right after dinner, but several hours later, when it's time to go to bed, you're going to be wide awake.
Are there certain rituals you recommend in preparing for sleep?
Any ritual which is going to be relaxing and comforting for you is a good ritual, whether that be taking a hot bath or a shower or reading in bed or watching something casual on TV, anything that works for you. And it's going to be different from person to person. It's nice having rituals because we get conditioned to the rituals, and that tells our bodies that it's time to start winding down and getting ready to go to sleep.
What about if you wake up a couple of times, once or twice during the night, and you need the bathroom? You know, you say you've been drinking tea or water through the evening, and that catches up with you in the middle of the night. Does that totally disrupt your sleep pattern?
It doesn't have to at all. Everybody wakes up during the night. And usually when we wake up at night, we realize that we need to go to the bathroom. It's not the needing to go to the bathroom that wakes you. Usually there's something else that's waking you. But once you're awake, you become aware of your body and you say, ah, I think I'll go use the bathroom. What you want to do, though, is try to keep yourself from waking up too much. So that would mean not turning on the lights. If you have difficulty seeing your way to the bathroom, you might want to put a nightlight in the bathroom so you have a little bit of dim light. But avoid turning on the overhead lights. Keep your eyes sort of half closed and only half open. Make your way to the bathroom, do your business, and then go back to bed. The idea being, again, to try to keep yourself in that transitional state where you're not fully awake and you're not fully asleep. And that'll make it easier to go back to sleep when you get back to bed.
My guest is Dr. Sonia Ancoli Israel. She's the author of the new book, All I Want is a Good Night's Sleep. We'll take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. Sonia Ancoli Israel. She directs the Sleep Disorders Clinic at Veterans Affairs Medical Center in San Diego, and she's also a professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of California in San Diego. Now, you don't seem to be a fan of compensatory naps. Do you recommend naps at all?
There is a place for naps in certain people's lives. I just can't generalize to everybody. I'm not a fan of someone who has difficulty sleeping at night taking a 2-hour nap. Our body only needs a certain amount of sleep in a 24-hour period. And if you get 2 hours of that during the day, you're going to need that much less at night. If you look at other cultures, like in South America, where they take siestas on a regular daily basis, they get the same amount of sleep that we do in a 24-hour period. They're just doing it in two blocks. They're taking some in the afternoon. They then stay up very late. They have a late dinner, and they get less sleep at night than we do. If that's the pattern you want to keep, then there's no problem taking a nap. But if you want your full night's sleep to be at night, then taking a nap could very well interfere with that. Now, there are some people who can sleep half an hour in the afternoon. They feel very refreshed, and it doesn't disturb their sleep at night. I have no problem with that. And in fact, feeling sleepy in the afternoon is a very natural part of our system. Our circadian rhythm, our 24-hour temperature cycle, very much affects when we feel sleepy and when we feel alert. When our temperature cycle begins to drop, that's when we get sleepy. And temperature takes a big drop at night, which is why we get sleepy around 10 or 11 at night. But it also takes a little dip in the late afternoon, around 3, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And that's why we often feel tired at that time. It's not just because we had a big meal at lunch. It's because our bodies, in fact, prefer and want to rest at that hour because of this temperature dip.
I find with myself that if I take a nap, I usually feel worse when I wake up than I did when I began. And I'm wondering if you have any suggestions, if you do want to or feel you need to take a nap, is there a best time for it and is there a best length for it?
I would say the best time is around 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and I would limit it to half an hour.
Why?
It has to do, again, with the circadian rhythm of the clock, of the body. It has to do with when the body wants to sleep. And if you lay down when the body is most tired, then you'll have an easier time falling asleep, and the quality of your sleep will be better. And limiting it to half an hour is to keep it from interfering with your nighttime sleep.
If you have a hard time sleeping on a regular basis, is it wise to take sleeping pills?
I would always want to know what's causing the difficulty sleeping first, because it could be that adding the sleeping pill might make it worse rather than better. For example, if the difficulty sleeping is caused by some medication that you're taking, adding a sleeping pill won't help. If the sleeping difficulty is caused by a sleep disorder such as sleep apnea, then adding the sleeping pill might actually make it worse. And so a sleeping pill is good once you know that the insomnia is stress-related or that there's nothing else serious going on that's causing it. Then it's okay to take a sleeping pill for a short time period.
How short?
I would say 2 to 3 weeks, a month at the most. And if the problem hasn't improved, if it hasn't gone away, then it's time to seriously delve into the issue in more detail to figure out what's causing it.
What are the differences between prescription sleeping pills and over-the-counter sleeping pills?
The difference is in what's in them, basically. The over-the-counter sleeping pills usually have something like an antihistamine in it, which makes you sleepy as a side effect. It's not the primary reason for that substance, but the sleepiness is one of the side effects, and that's why people use it to help them sleep at night. The prescription sleeping pills have other compounds in them that are specifically made to make you fall asleep or help you fall asleep. That's the primary action of the sleeping pill rather than the side effect as in the over-the-counter.
If you had your choice, which pill would be less likely to leave you groggy and hungover the next day?
They can all do it depending on how much you take and when you take it. And I would recommend that no one take any of it without talking to their physician first.
Mm-hmm. Say your physician was happy to prescribe it for you and felt it would help you.
As many will.
Right. Is there any difference in the after effects of the antihistamine and the prescription?
The antihistamines aren't really meant to be used as sleeping pills, although people use them. And they can have all sorts of side effects in addition to the making you sleepy at night, which might make you very uncomfortable. The prescription sleeping pills, if they're used correctly, and by correctly I mean at the lowest possible dose that still helps you, taking them for only about a month at a time, and trying not to take them every night. If they're used properly, then they can be very beneficial in improving the insomnia complaint. The key is not to use them every night for months and months at a time, because then you can become addicted to them. Your body becomes very tolerant, and you need to take more and more and more, and then it becomes less effective rather than more effective.
Dr. Sonia Ancoli Israel is the author of the new book, All I Want is a Good Night's Sleep, published by Mosby. She'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Just as much it really means. Hey, I see the moon, and the moon is pale, and it look like they're taking some cat to jail. No, it's the moon is pale, and the sun is, and the sun is gone, and the steamboats are coming, and they're splashing in the garden. Woo woo! Bubbles, and the pale moon shining on the fields below. Folks all singing songs soft and low. You need to tell me more, 'cause I know. Sleepy time down south, south wind blowing through the pine wood trees, and the folks down there live a life of ease. When old mammy falls upon her knees, the sleepy time down south, steamboats on the river, coming a-going, splashing the night time. Hey, Baba Buggles, banjos ringing, everybody singing. They dance till the break of day. Hey, if you don't stop them, our trip is on. And you take me back there, where I belong. I would love to be if my man was on.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The FDA doesn't regulate it. Sleep experts disagree on its effectiveness. Coming up, sleep disorders expert Sonia Ancoli Israel discusses melatonin, and John Powers reviews A Time to Kill.
Bye bye, baby. Time to hit the road to dreamland. Bye bye, baby. I'll dig you in the land of none. Hold tight, baby. We'll be swinging high in dreamland all night, baby, where little cherubs trod. Look at that knocked out moon, fiddle blowing his top in the blue. Never saw the likes of you. What an angel. Bye bye, baby, time to hit the road to dreamland. Don't cry, baby. It was divine, but the rooster has finally crowed. Time to hit the road.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Back with Dr. Sonia Ancoli Israel, author of the new book, All I Want is a Good Night's Sleep. She directs the Sleep Disorders Clinic at the San Diego Veterans Affairs Medical Center and teaches at the School of Medicine of the University of California in San Diego. Earlier, we talked a bit about sleeping pills. I wanted to hear her thoughts about a sleeping aid that's become quite popular. Now, what about melatonin, which a lot of people are buying now, over the counter, mostly at health food stores,
right?
And that's, I think, supposed to be a hormone that's
correct,
related to sleep. What is
correct
melatonin?
It's just as you said, Terry. Melatonin is a hormone that's produced by our brain, and it does have a major. It plays a major role in our sleep-wake cycle. As we get older, the amount of melatonin that we produce decreases. And so older people have substantially less melatonin in their body than younger people. There's several problems, however, with buying the melatonin over the counter. The first is we have no idea what is in that tablet that you're buying. It's usually not pure melatonin. It often has other substances in it as well, and we don't always know what those substances are. We don't know where the melatonin is coming from. We don't know if it's a synthetic melatonin or if it's coming from some animals. We don't know if it's pure or if it's contaminated. And so those of us in the profession are very hesitant to recommend that people buy melatonin and use it when they're buying it in the health food stores. We think that melatonin has a lot of potential. We need more research. The research hasn't answered the questions yet as to what is the correct dose that should be used. It hasn't answered the question about what is the right timing, when is the best time to take it. And melatonin can have other side effects to it that many people aren't aware of.
Such as?
Such as it has a direct effect on the reproduction system. In animals, it's the melatonin that controls when they reproduce. And so I would worry very much if a teenager, for example, was taking melatonin, because we don't know what it may be doing to that teenager's reproductive system.
When you say that there might be other substances mixed in with the melatonin,
mm-hmm,
are you thinking of a specific substance?
Well, actually, I am. I have one colleague who took some melatonin that he bought over the counter and had it analyzed. And that particular brand of melatonin had some benzodiazepine in it. And benzodiazepine is the substance that's in prescription sleeping pills. So it was no wonder that that particular brand helped people fall asleep.
Right. So you recommend caution when
absolute caution if you're going to use the melatonin.
I have a chicken and egg question for you. I know that depression can cause insomnia, but can bad sleep habits cause depression? I mean, is it sometimes hard to tell which is causing which?
It's very difficult to tell, because if you have really had multiple nights of poor sleep, you are going to feel depressed. You are going to feel let down and unhappy. And so it's very difficult to know which is causing which. And it takes a good professional to make the distinction and to try to tease out what's what.
Now, don't some of the drugs for depression, like Prozac, for example, sometimes cause insomnia as a side effect?
That's right, it does. And many of the antidepressants, other than Prozac, cause sleepiness. And so if you're taking a lot during the day, it's going to make you sleepy during the day. And if you sleep too much during the day, then you have more trouble sleeping at night. On the other hand, some of the antidepressants are used in very low, low doses to help people who have difficulty sleeping for that same reason. Instead of using a sleeping pill, some physicians recommend a low dose of an antidepressant. So you sort of take care of both the depressive feeling and the insomnia at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Let me get into a more unusual problem, and that is the sense that you're about to fall asleep and then your leg kicks and your body jumps and you've
right.
just woken yourself up.
Right. First, let's describe there's a normal process that happens as you fall asleep, where you feel like your body's falling and you jerk as if to stop yourself from falling.
Mm-hmm.
That's called a hypnic jerk. And it's very normal, and it happens to everybody. There is another process, however, where your legs kick or jerk every 20 to 40 seconds for periods throughout the night. And each time they jerk, it wakes you up. That's called periodic limb movements in sleep. And that is a real sleep disorder, which causes a lot of insomnia.
And is there a cure for it?
There's a treatment for it. It's not a cure. The treatment involves different medications. There are three different types of medications that are tried, and usually it's a trial and error. You have to work with individual patients to see which treatment would work best for them.
Mm-hmm. What are the different phases of sleep in the course of a night?
There are five stages of sleep that we go through. The first four are sort of lumped together and are called non-REM or non-rapid eye movement sleep. And within that, they're broken down into stages 1 through 4. Stage 1 is the very lightest level of sleep, where you're just dozing off. You're not completely asleep yet, but you're not fully awake anymore either. And then the stages get progressively deeper, with stage 4 being a very deepest level of sleep. The fifth stage is called REM, or rapid eye movement sleep. And this is our dream sleep. This is where we do most of our dreaming. And the reason it's called rapid eye movement sleep is that during REM, our eyes move very rapidly. In addition, during REM, we lose all muscle tension except for our eyes and our respiration. We're actually paralyzed during REM. And this is believed to be a protective mechanism which keeps us from acting out our dreams. And we have no idea what any of this means.
Well, I thought, you know, hey, common wisdom, we sleep because we need the rest, and you're not moving. In fact, you're paralyzed during some of it.
Right.
And you're not thinking in a conscious way. Maybe you're dreaming.
Right.
And then, you know, you wake up supposedly refreshed.
Right. Well, that's certainly a theory. I mean, we think the body needs a sleep because of it's restorative in some sense. Some people think that it's a time for memory to consolidate. Some people think that it has to do with just the homeostatic balance within the body, that the more time we spend awake, the more sleep we need, and the more time we sleep, the more time we will then stay awake. And all these things are probably true. It's just that we don't know the exact details yet of how and why they work.
My guest is Dr. Sonia Ancoli Israel, author of the new book, All I Want is a Good Night's Sleep. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Sonia Ancoli Israel. Her new book is called All I Want is a Good Night's Sleep. Sometimes sleeping is not the relaxing experience it's billed as being. A lot of people grind their teeth as they sleep or twist themselves into knots as they sleep and wake up with a lot of body tension, more than they even went to bed with. It's always surprising to me that sleeping, which is billed as a relaxing experience, can actually be a very tense experience.
Absolutely. And if you're experiencing any sort of daytime sleepiness, that's a very serious sign that you're not getting enough sleep at night. And the question is, are you not getting enough sleep just because you're not in bed long enough and you're sleep depriving yourself? Or are you not getting enough sleep because something's going on with your body that keeps you from sleeping? For example, the most serious example would be sleep apnea or sleep disordered breathing, where people think they're, quote, sleeping like a log, unquote. That's what they always say. But in fact, their body stops breathing whenever they fall asleep. They're not getting oxygen to their brain or to their body. They have to wake up to start breathing again, so they're waking up sometimes hundreds of times during the night. But these awakenings are all so brief that they don't even realize that they're waking up. They think they're sleeping fine all day long, all night long. And so their sleep is very disruptive. They can't sleep and breathe at the same time. They spend a lot of time during the night in these brief awakenings, and during the day, they're exhausted. And this can be a very serious problem.
Now, is their partner, their spouse, more likely to be aware of this than they are? Or does this get expressed in loud snoring, for instance?
Yes. This definitely, one of the main symptoms is very loud snoring. And we ask our patients, how loud do you snore? Can you be heard only in your bedroom? Can you be heard one room away? Can you be heard two rooms? Are you a two-room snorer? Can your neighbors hear you? And they often say yes, because they often snore so loudly. Usually the bed partner has moved out of the bedroom because he or she, usually it's a she, can't stand sleeping with the snoring. And I say it's a she not because I'm being sexist, but it seems that sleep apnea is more common in men than in women. Although women do snore, and as we get older, we snore more and more. So snoring is one of the primary symptoms. The other symptom is this daytime sleepiness, this falling asleep at the desk, falling asleep every time you sit quietly in front of the TV or reading, or in the real serious cases, while driving.
Now for snoring, if you do snore a lot, how can you stop?
Okay, there's several things. The first question is it snoring that's just when you're on your back? Because, of course, that makes snoring worse. Or is it in all positions? If you snore just on your back, then, of course, the trick is to stay off your back. And the way you do that is you sew a pocket into the back of a T-shirt or the back of the pajamas, and you put in a tennis ball. And it's sort of a variation on the old Princess and the Pea story. Of course, as soon as you roll over on your back, it's so uncomfortable, you roll right back off again. And it's very effective in stopping snoring that occurs just in that position. Weight makes snoring worse. So if you snore loudly and you're overweight, losing weight, sometimes losing as little as 20 or 30 pounds, and I know that's not a little, that's a lot to lose, but if you can lose that amount, then that could improve the snoring. Alcohol and sleeping pills will both make snoring worse. So avoid alcohol at night and avoid taking sleeping pills. And sometimes just being overtired can make the snoring worse. The snoring is caused by a partial obstruction in the airway, whether it's flabby tissue or large tonsils or a long uvula, you know, that piece that hangs down in the back of your throat.
Mm-hmm.
And as the air passes these excess tissues, the tissues vibrate, and that's what causes the snoring sound. And when you're excessively tired, the muscles relax even more, and so you get more of this vibration.
And if you have the sleep apnea problem that you were describing before, where you basically stop breathing as you fall asleep, and that wakes you back up again, and that's accompanied by loud snoring, is there a different way to deal with that?
Absolutely. The treatment for that is very different, because there, it's not the snoring you're concerned about, it's the breathing. And you want to make sure that the people keep breathing during the night. The treatment of choice right now is a device called a CPAP machine. That stands for Continuous Positive Airway Pressure. It's a nose piece which is attached via a hose to a machine that pushes positive pressure through the airway, which acts as a splint to keep the airway open. Let me back up here a minute. The apnea is usually caused by the muscles of the airway collapsing in so that the airway is blocked. It's as if you remember the days when we had paper straws and you would suck real hard on a paper straw, the walls of the straw would collapse. The same thing is happening in the airway. And so this CPAP machine pushes the positive pressure through the airway and it keeps the airway open so that you can keep breathing.
How common is this?
Studies have shown that in younger, by younger I mean middle-aged populations, it's about 4% in men and 2% in women. In our own research in elderly, and by elderly we define that as age 65 and older, it's much more common. It's about 28% men and 19% women.
That's a lot.
It's a lot.
You say in your book that the ability to sleep is something you can learn. How much can you learn?
You can learn a lot. The body is trainable. And part of training it has to do with learning the good sleep hygiene techniques, has to do with keeping fit. Exercise, for example, if you exercise on a regular basis, it actually helps you sleep better at night. What you can't learn is to get by on less sleep, and that's, of course, what everybody wants to do. You know, I want to teach myself to sleep only 4 hours a night so I have more time to spend doing all the things I need to do. That doesn't work. It might work for a few nights, but at some point it's going to catch up with you, and you're going to have to get more sleep.
Now, a lot of the research that you've done has to do with sleep and older people.
Right.
65 and older.
Right.
And you've even done a lot of research in nursing homes. How does the biological clock change when you get older?
Basically, the biological clock begins to shift. So, for example, in a younger to middle-aged adult, the body begins getting sleepy at about 10 or 11 o'clock at night. And if you have a good night's sleep, you sleep about 8 hours, which means that you wake up at about 7 in the morning. As we age, this whole pattern shifts forward in time. So an older person tends to get sleepy earlier in the evening, around 7, 8 o'clock. And if they were, in fact, to go to bed then, they would still sleep about 8 hours. But that means they're now waking up at about 4 in the morning, which is exactly what older people complain about. They wake up early in the morning and they can't get back to sleep. The problem is that even though the older people get sleepy earlier in the evening, they're not going to bed at 8 o'clock. They're still staying up till 10 or 11 because that's more socially acceptable. But their bodies are still waking up at 4 in the morning. So now they've restricted the amount of sleep that they can get because they're not in bed long enough during the time that their body wants to sleep. And so they tend to be more tired during the day. They tend to report taking more naps during the day because they are, in fact, sleepy. And we call this an advanced sleep phase because the rhythm is actually advanced.
So you really have to know something about your biological rhythm and honor it.
Absolutely.
Now, what about the biological rhythms of very young people, of children?
Right. Especially teenagers. We always get parents complaining that the teenagers are sleeping till noon, and why are they so lazy? In fact, first of all, let me say that teenagers need about 10 hours sleep. They need more sleep. Younger children, of course, also need about 10 or 11 hours sleep, but teenagers still need that amount of sleep. What happens to the rhythm in the teenager is it gets delayed. So now, instead of getting sleepy at 10, 11 o'clock at night, they don't get sleepy till 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And then they still want to sleep their 8, 9, or 10 hours, but that means they're waking up at 10, 11, 12 o'clock in the afternoon. So their whole rhythm has been pushed ahead in time. It's what we call a delayed sleep phase.
Now, you're saying that that's a natural rhythm in teenagers?
It's a very natural rhythm in teenagers,
It's not just
college-age
partying.
It's not. Of course, that contributes to it. But one of the reasons they're able to stay out late partying is their bodies are still awake. To wake someone who has a delayed sleep phase, to try to wake them at 7 or 8 in the morning is like waking the rest of us at 3 in the morning. Their body is in the middle of its sleep cycle, and it just doesn't want to get up.
Is there any other explanation for what we call daytime people and nighttime people?
No, it's very much based on your rhythm. People who are more delayed tend to be night people. People who are a little more advanced tend to be morning or day people, or what we call owls and larks.
You've done a lot of research in nursing homes related to body rhythms. What are some of the things you found by studying nursing homes?
The sleep in patients in nursing homes is extremely fragmented and disturbed. We found that on average, the nursing home patient is rarely asleep for a full hour or awake for a full hour throughout the 24-hour day. That means that they're constantly falling asleep and waking up and falling asleep and waking up. They're never getting a full night's sleep. Now, there are many things that contribute to this problem in the nursing home. Certainly, the breakdown of the circadian rhythms is part of it. Another aspect is the fact that most nursing home patients spend most of their day sitting inside the nursing home. Whether it be in the hallway or in a multi-purpose room, they're generally not getting very much bright light exposure. So that also contributes to the breakdown of the circadian rhythm. Many nursing home patients spend a lot of time in bed, either because they're quite ill or because the staff puts them in bed because they have so many patients to take care of. They can't always get everybody to bed at 7 at night, so they might start putting them to bed at 3 in the afternoon. But that means that these patients are spending way too much time in bed, which, as we said, disrupts their sleep. Of course, medication use and illness all contribute to the poor sleep. And so all these factors come in together to play a role in the problems that nursing home patients have.
I wonder if you think that your research into sleep and all the studies you've done about sleep have helped you sleep any better.
I may be a little embarrassed to say have no problem sleeping and never have. I am a great sleeper. What it has taught me over the years is when I do wake up at night or when I do have that occasional insomnia, to not give in to the temptation to look at the clock or to try to stay relaxed. And it has helped. It really has helped.
Do you enjoy sleeping?
I love sleeping.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about sleep. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Sonia Ancoli Israel is the author of All I Want is a Good Night's Sleep, published by Mosby. She directs the Sleep Disorders Clinic at the San Diego Veterans Affairs Medical Center. Coming up, a review of the new movie, A Time to Kill. This is Fresh Air. The latest John Grisham novel to be adapted into a film is actually his first. A Time to Kill, starring Samuel L. Jackson and Matthew McConaughey, opens today. John Powers has a review.
If there were a Nobel Prize for summer reading, the winner would surely be John Grisham. This lawyer-turned-novelist has transformed his disdain for the legal system into gripping, crudely written bestsellers that barely pause for breath on their way to Hollywood. Three of Grisham's novels have already become hit movies: The Firm, The Client, and The Pelican Brief. Now comes A Time to Kill, sort of a wrought-up 90s version of To Kill a Mockingbird. In the opening scene, two slavering crackers rape a 10-year-old black girl. After they've been arrested, they're gunned down in the courthouse by the girl's father, a decent man named Carl Lee Haley. Put on trial for murder by a ruthless DA, Carl Lee's only hope is a young white lawyer, Jake Brigance. Jake takes the case, getting moral support from his mentor, a lavishly Faulknerian drunkard played by Donald Sutherland. Unless you've lived in a media-free zone for the last month, you'll know that A Time to Kill's real drama is not whether Carl Lee will be acquitted, but whether actor Matthew McConaughey, who plays Jake, can ever live up to all those fawning articles and cheesecake photos. To judge from this movie, he's got a chance. The camera loves him. He looks like a slightly askew Paul Newman. And he's more effortlessly emotional than either Brad Pitt or Keanu Reeves. Even so, he's completely overshadowed by Samuel Jackson, who plays Carl Lee. Jackson dominates the movie with his authority, as when he explains to Jake the facts of racial life.
America is a war, and you on the other side. How a black man ever gonna get a fair trial with the enemy on the bench in the jury box? My life in white hands. You, Jake, that's how. You my secret weapon, 'cause you one of the bad guys. You don't mean to be, but you are. Negro, black, African-American, no matter how you see me as different. You see me like that jury sees me. You are them. Now throw out your points of law, Jake. If you was on that jury, what would it take to convince you to set me free?
A Time to Kill was directed by Joel Schumacher, who made The Last Batman, and employs the same bombastic style here. Which is not to say that the movie doesn't pull you along. I saw it with a sneak preview audience, and they were with it all the way. But what exactly were they with? The movie supposedly turns on a simple question of race. Can the black Carl Lee get a fair trial in the bigoted South? But this racial question is actually a red herring. What the movie's really about is vigilante justice. The white attorney and the black defendant share a visceral belief in an eye for an eye. The movie plays on our desire for blood vengeance so that we wind up applauding vigilantism, as if denying the rule of law were somehow a triumph for the civil rights movement. The film's unnerving message doesn't stop there. Like every Grisham tale, A Time to Kill centers on a heroic loner caught up in a corrupt world. Not only must Jake battle in the courtroom, he's also caught between malignant outside forces. On one hand, the Klan terrorizes him and his loved ones because he's defending Carl Lee. On the other, the NAACP wants him removed from the case so they can turn the trial to their own political purposes. In one of the most thoughtlessly offensive moments in modern movie history, Schumacher actually cuts from a shot of the NAACP leaders, complete with their oily East Coast lawyer, to a shot of a Ku Klux Klan rally, thereby branding the two groups as equivalent. A Time to Kill is being billed as a progressive, idealistic movie. In fact, it should give pause to anyone, on the right or the left, who thinks of Hollywood as a bastion of liberalism. This is a movie that says America's a great country because a black man can be a vigilante too.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Thank you. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Roberta Shurrock, with Joan Tui Westman, Louisa Shafia, and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Additional assistance from Phoebe Vanskoy. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Cherry Gross.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, exhuming mass graves in Bosnia. We'll talk with forensic anthropologist William Hagland, who is leading a team of investigators for the International Criminal Tribunal. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.